You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The word spy conjures up images of James Bond and Jason Bourne, or memories of Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen's arrests, but not of a grad school dropout working for his parents' business. That's what Naveed Jamali was when the FBI recruited him to give classified documents to a Russian intelligence agent. For 3 years, he served as a double agent working with the FBI to take down a Russian espionage operation in the U.S. His book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent, is published by Scribner. And I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Jamali to our show today. Hello.
Hey. Thrilled to be here.
By the way, written with the help of Ellis Hennigan.
That's right.
How did you start working with the FBI? Did you reach out to the FBI or did they reach out to you?
I reached out to them. We had this sort of odd family connection that started in the late 80s when the Soviets actually approached my parents. My parents ran a small business. It was actually here in New York City at Columbus Circle. And the Russians came in and asked to buy books. And shortly thereafter, the FBI came in and said, what did the man who just came in here with Soviet intelligence, what did he want? And my parents said, well, he wanted to buy some books. And the FBI said, well, get him his books. So there started this.
Any special kinds of books?
You know, they were yes. I mean, this wasn't Harry Potter or things like that. I mean, the man was from the UN. They were books on like nuclear disarmament or arms control, very, very heady, sort of academic, you know, as I joke, things that probably two people a year read, one of whom is the author's mother. So it was.
But they're available in any bookstore, and they would probably today be available through Amazon.
Yeah,
some of the
stuff was, but then there was also government reports. But look, I mean, it clearly wasn't classified information, but on the other hand, it wasn't things that, as we found later on, that the Russians necessarily wanted to know that they were interested in.
They wanted copies of proceedings from obscure conferences.
They did. Absolutely. Look, the sort of running way to look at this is to say that your enemies may know what you want, but you only want your friends to know what you need.
But none of this was top secret stuff.
No, absolutely not.
So the FBI, of course, had to trust your parents to be doing what they wanted.
Of course. Well, I mean, the FBI didn't really want them to do anything other than just give the Russians what they wanted, what the books they wanted.
Well, when you went to the FBI, what did you have to do to convince them that they could trust you?
You know, as it turns out, not that much at the onset. This is all about motivation. And I explained to the FBI innocently and genuinely that I wanted to help them simply because I'd applied to become an intelligence officer in the Navy and had been rejected and was reapplying. And I wanted to get simply a letter of recommendation or something for my resume.
Do you know why you were rejected the first time you applied?
Oh,
do they tell you that?
They don't specifically tell you, but I imagine it was, look, I made it to the final round and I didn't have any prior intelligence experience, and I imagine that worked against me.
What about now? You're in the Navy Reserve.
I am.
So are you working in intelligence?
I still am an intelligence officer, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So what did you offer the Russians that your parents were not offering them?
Two things. First is we started to give them more and more interesting things, and that was a feat in itself, to find things that I would organically have access to that I could pass them. And secondly, me. I mean, what the Russians were interested in was not just the information I was providing them, but rather developing a long-term source.
So now they were buying from your parents and from you as well.
No. At this point, my parents were retiring. The reason I had approached the FBI is they were retiring. I was taking over the family business, and I approached the FBI and said, look, I'm taking over the account. Perhaps there's some way that I can push the relationship, and in exchange, would you help me?
And in this case, you were thinking about becoming a double agent or just simply continuing what
absolutely.
Your parents were
doing? I was thinking of nothing more than a letter of recommendation for the Navy. That was it. No higher purpose.
Are most double agents amateurs like you?
I can't speak to – I would say that you'd be surprised. Look, here's a basic question. Are most spies amateurs? And the answer is yes. And a double agent is some, you know, variation of a spy. There's no training necessarily to become a spy. Perhaps one of the things that surprises most people is that when you say spy, you're not referring to people like Oleg, who was my spy handler. Oleg's job here as a Russian intelligence officer was not to actually spy, but rather to recruit spies for him. So yes, to answer your question, Leonard, most spies are not trained in that field, in that art.
And he was recruiting you to do what?
To spy.
A spy on what?
On anything that I could get my hands on. The Russians, and I imagine most intelligence agencies, are, if nothing else, opportunistic. I mean, they will take whatever they can get.
So you're learning on the job.
Absolutely.
Really. You just have to be clever. He asks you for something, and you have to figure out how to deal with it.
Well, to be fair, 50% of the discussion is the Russians trying to figure out what use I can be to them. So, I mean, that part of that is to kind of guide them in a specific way.
And what did you guide them to think about you?
Well, part of it was saying what I had access to certain systems and that there were certain projects that we were running through my company that perhaps might be of interest to them. So it was very much trying to guide them in a very specific and general direction, but letting the Russians take control.
And you had access to things that others might not have?
Yes.
How come?
Through my company. I mean, that was a whole part of the basis to try to make the Russians believe that we weren't faking it. I actually would get access to certain systems in order to, I mean, we wouldn't tell the agencies, but this was in large part to try to, you know, lure the Russians in.
But you had to be sure that you weren't giving them anything that could be of total value. And didn't Oleg's superiors complain?
No. You know, look, this was the interesting thing is that this really was like being in a startup. The FBI, to their credit, and as I learned later, perhaps it was more that they didn't want their fingerprints on this if anything went wrong. But they basically would say to me, how do you want to do this? What's the right way to do this? And it really became up to me to sort of figure out, if I was a real spy, how would I really spy? And that was the question that I had to answer all the time.
My guest is Navid Jamali. His book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. You write that you modeled a lot of what you were doing on spy movies.
Absolutely.
Well, what movies were you watching? What were you learning from them? I mean, you're not going to learn much from the Bourne conspiracy.
Well, so here's the interesting thing is that—
Did you buy an MG?
I was always an American car guy. So, but what you do learn— look,
Aston Martin, I guess it was.
Yes, Aston Martin. But what you do learn from spy movies and books is not the art, not the spy craft, but rather— motivation and the character. And what I was using my name. My name is Navid Jamali, and the Russians, I'm sure, knew where I lived, knew what kind of car I drove. Those are not things that I could change. But what I could change was my motivation, why they believed I was doing this. So I was doing it because I wanted simply a letter of recommendation for the Navy, but I couldn't explain that to the Russians. So I had to come up with some motivation that would be believable to their profile. And part of that was to develop a character, and that character was loosely based on characters from various movies that I had seen along the way.
And in what ways?
Well, I chose, one of my favorite was Michael Mann. Michael Mann's a great director, Manhunter, and Miami Vice, which I think came out in 2006, was one of his latest tomes. And I would actually lift dialogue from the two protagonists, the two police officers who were undercover, and use that dialogue when I met with the Russians. And for whatever reason, it just worked. They believed it, that here's this young American who's materialistic and incredibly, you know, arrogant and egotistical. And, you know, what better way to, you know, convey that than lines from Hollywood?
And then it didn't hurt that you told him that you wanted to get into Navy intelligence.
No, of course not.
He thought, well, they hit the jackpot. You'll be an incredible source.
Of course. Of course.
How did you meet Oleg, your Russian handler? Is that that's not his real name.
That is his real name.
Uh-huh.
No pseudonyms with Oleg. Oleg Kulikov, captain in the Russian Navy and a member of the United, the Russians' mission to the United Nations and part of the military staff committee at the UN. He showed up at my office, simply as that. Look, the Russians for 20 years had been coming to my parents' office. And when I took over that strategic account, he showed up one day.
Did he seem particularly easy to fool? Did he seem particularly competent or incompetent?
Very competent. You know, people ask me, am I scared of the Russians? And look, I look at the Russians now, and certainly as Oleg, as trained, professional, very competent. I mean, look, for someone like Oleg to come to the United States, it's not your first posting. You have to be a senior person. You have to be very good at what you do. And frankly, he was. I mean, he was an incredibly skilled interrogator. When we meet with him, it was nothing short but him interrogating me.
Was the information you gave him all real?
Absolutely.
So you didn't give him anything that the government might have wanted the Russians
to know? No, everything that I gave the Russians was things that I would have had access organically through my company. So it was all real.
What was the most sensitive piece of information you gave?
Well, I mean, so when you talk about that, you know, you're thinking about that in the intelligence world, that has a very legal connotation, right? So I'll answer this two ways. First of all, the first is when you say classified, there's no such thing as a classified document. It's either top secret or secret. And frankly, when I got to the Navy, one of the most surprising things is documents that are classified, that have a secret or top secret classification, they may not be that interesting. Just because they have that classification doesn't mean that they're necessarily damaging.
In fact, in some cases, people just stamp everything
top secret. It's overclassified. Absolutely. So there's a huge bucket of things called open source information. And that open source information, as you mentioned, Amazon, a lot of the reports that we were passing the Russians over the years were things like production capabilities or things about radars, very intricate reports that were written at, you know, academia, at Fortune 50 companies. These are real, but they're unclassified. And so to answer the second part about the most sensitive, some of these things were potentially export controlled, which means that they were not to be distributed outside the United States.
Did Oleg give you anything in return for the information?
Of course. He gave me money.
And what happened with that money?
I gave it to the FBI, and they did what they did with it.
Did they pay you for your work?
They didn't pay me for the work, but they did allow me at one point at the end to receive a check and from the FBI, which was very, you know, I was somewhat uncomfortable with it, and even more so uncomfortable with it that what do I do with money from the FBI? And it turns out that you have to declare it on your – I had to declare it on my taxes. So everything was done lawfully. But it was this weird thing that I can sort of say that in an odd twist, the Russians essentially funded the operation against them.
My guest is Navid Jamali, J-A-M-A-L-I, his book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. It is published by Scribner. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Navid Jamali, who, with the help of Ellis Hennekin, has written a book called How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent, published by Scribner's. Did you record your conversations?
Didn't record them, but the FBI did give me a watch that allowed me to record the conversations for them.
A watch,
of all things.
This
now
is,
you
this
kind
is
of laugh.
Apple
that.
Came.
That's
up
right.
With
I was
that
about
watch?
To say. Now you think about an Apple or a Fitbit watch or something like that. But yeah, that is exactly right. The when you talk about trust, the reason, large part, that the FBI was comfortable with me is that they were able to listen in after the fact or real time.
So you were really broadcasting your conversations. Where were you meeting with him?
Only the best of the best for Navid Jamali. The Russians would take me to essentially chain restaurants such as Pizzeria Uno's and, oh, by the way, Hooters. So if you haven't gone to Hooters with a Russian spy, you haven't lived.
Now, do you think he went to Hooters because he liked the idea of Hooters or because it was the kind of place you could
meet freely?
Not be watching the same way as you would if you were eating at Daniel or La Bernadette.
Right. So the 16-year-old boy in me wants to say that he went there because he liked Hooters. But I think objectively there probably was more to it than that. There was a level of – look, these were sophisticated people. They're concerned about surveillance and counter-surveillance. It wasn't that he just got up in the morning, got into his car and drove and met me. There was very complex method to make sure that he wasn't being followed.
Now, was anything here illegal? After all, you were handing him stuff
absolutely.
Was readily available.
Oh, he's a diplomat. He's not supposed to direct civilians or citizens of other countries to spy. I mean, he was completely committing espionage. It doesn't matter if it's open source or he was directing a person to commit espionage. Completely illegal. And that's – look, no one's surprised that happens, but it's very rare that you actually catch someone in the act.
Why do you think it lasted 3 years?
In spy world, that's probably not that long. The Russians were looking at – they wanted to build a long-term asset. If I could have continued working for them for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they would have been very, very happy. It takes a tremendous amount of time to develop a source, to trust them, to validate them, to verify them, and then to make them operational. It's a slow dance. There's no rush to it.
And did you realize that you were going to be making such a long commitment when
Absolutely
you started?
Absolutely not. I didn't think any – I had no idea what I was going to get myself into the first time I met with the FBI.
in the spy movies, the real complication is when the double agent wants to meet with the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to do it secretly?
Of course. I mean, the FBI was
right. Did they also want to go to Hooters?
No. Is
that at a park bench? And
well, for the
left
for
something
the,
by yeah. on the bench and
we,
then left.
We absolutely, you know, all kidding aside, we did. We did actually meet. You know, I live in New York City, and they would meet me in various locations in New York. But they were very concerned about meeting with me and making sure if the Russians were tailing me that they weren't seen with me. So,
do you think the Russians were watching you?
Absolutely, I'm sure of it. Now they had to do it in such a way that you know wouldn't arouse suspicions, because if the people who are watching me are being watched by the FBI, it becomes this crazy thing where you'll drive
sounds
yourself
like something
mad.
Out of Mad Magazine.
Absolutely, if you start thinking about it too much, you will absolutely go crazy. But there was a level of safety. But for me, this was all comedy. I'm meeting with Oleg, and I understood conceptually that Oleg was a point person of Russian military intelligence, but I didn't see any of that behind him. I just saw Oleg.
But it must have also been stressful for you.
It was, sure.
You're living a double life.
Triple life. I was recently married. I had a career and a job. And then, oh, by the way, I'm a double agent. So it's these three silos, and it's very difficult to keep them separate.
How much did your wife know about this?
She knew about it, but, you know, again, Leonard, the odd thing is we call it the circle of trust. And the only people who knew what I was doing was my wife and two FBI agents. So it was hard to look at this and say that it was the FBI versus the Russians. I didn't see what was behind the FBI's curtain, nor did I see what was behind the Russians' curtain.
How did the FBI ultimately take down Oleg's espionage operation?
They arrested me. I mean, that was the...
They arrested you. That was a staged arrest.
That was a staged arrest. The last time Oleg was supposed to meet with me. Look, diplomats, as is common, they're only at a posting for so long. So after a number of years, he was set to go rotate back to Russia.
And he was planning to go back anyway.
Yeah. But so what is the impact that has? Well, it has a massive impact because now the Russians are sitting back as they're a professional intelligence agency, and they're going to look back and say, where's the hole? What else has been compromised? They're going to start looking and auditing everything. And so for a brief period of time, they're going to stop collecting information until they can be sure where the hole in the damage is.
Did the staged arrest go smoothly?
No. Part of it did. You know, as is with real life, you plan out as much as you can, and you try to control as much as you can. And the original... goal or the original plan was for me to meet Oleg and go into one restaurant, and we'd planned out the dialogue, planned out everything, planned out the signal, and I met him at the door, and the first thing Oleg said to me was, "Hey, Navid, it's good to see you. Do you want to go to a different restaurant?" Which happened to be Hooters, which is an odd twist. So from right there, from the first 10 seconds into it, we had a massive change, and I wasn't sure what the FBI was going to do. Were they going to freak out? I wasn't sure what the Russians were going to do. Was I going to walk across? They're going to throw me in the back of a van? It was very nerve-wracking.
But it just was he decided he wanted to eat at Hooters instead.
Well, I think it was probably an operational
like
decision. No, he probably figured that this is a safety net, change things at the last minute. Did he like Hooters? It's very possible. But I also think there's a strategic decision in there as well.
Now, did you feel any connection to Oleg? Did you like the guy?
No.
So you didn't feel bad for having betrayed him?
No. I didn't betray him. He knew the rules of the game. This is a gentleman's game. They're written and unwritten rules, and he messed up. He got burned, and he knew that coming in here. So that's not to say that I don't have respect for him. I think that he's a patriot and a nationalist in his own right, and I don't have any ill will towards him. But no, I didn't feel any connection to him. It was all business.
Were there any problems along the way? Do you think the Russians ever suspected you? Because during this time, Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned by the Russians while he was working as a double agent.
So I asked the FBI, I said, so guys, listen, do the Russians have guns? And they looked at me and they said, it's possible, but we don't think so. And I'm like, what does that mean? Is that a yes or no? So the FBI would never really give me, for questions like that, give me direct answers. So I surmise that it was unlikely that Oleg was armed, and it was even less likely that they were going to do anything to harm me. But yeah, look, there was one point where the Russians wanted me to leave the country with them. And
to go where?
To go to Mexico, of all places. And I was concerned that after the fact, the FBI said, it's probably not a good idea. And I thought about it. I said, it's probably right. If I got to a foreign country, things would be very different.
How did you get out of that?
I just think we never...
You said there'd no Hooters down there?
Yeah, that's right. That should have been a good fallback. But they just dropped it. We it just never came back up. And I said, I'll think about it. And they never brought it back up again.
Have you given up spying completely?
Spying is the second oldest trade, right? I mean, we spy. I have two kids. It's hard not to spy. But look, it's hard to be a double agent or a triple agent or a spy in the traditional sense when, you have a book and hopefully a movie coming out.
If someone wants to become a Navy intelligence officer, would you recommend that they take the path that you
did? No. In fact, I get that a lot. There's a lot of easier ways. And as you said in the onset of the show, go to graduate school. It's safer. It might be more expensive, but you're more likely to get in.
Do you have any advice that you'd give somebody who is becoming a double agent?
When it comes to this sort of work, it's all about motivation. And as long as you understand what your motivation is and what the motivation that you have to project to your adversary, that's the key.
Now, Oleg was arrested, but then he just was shipped back to Russia.
That's right.
Do we know what happened to him?
I have a sense of where it is. And it's. I guess I can say that it's nice to know that regardless of what government you work for, if you mess up, they're going to put you out to pasture. So he's still alive. I'm fairly certain that he's not in the government employ, and he's certainly not doing any intelligence work anymore. But look, he stuck his neck out to say that I was a real spy and got burned on it.
Of course, he wasn't alone. A number of people probably in the embassy or consulate passed on you.
Listen, my parents for 20 years working for the FBI, I'm sure that those people that met with my parents, look, to come to New York as an intelligence officer for the Soviets or the Russians is a senior posting. It's fair to assume that some of those people that worked here are now back in senior positions in Moscow. It's got to be a little bit embarrassing for them.
Your book is being made into a movie.
Yes.
Do you know who's playing you?
I don't. I mean, the only information I have, and I'm very excited about, is that Mark Webb, who did Spider-Man, is the director, and Mark Heyman, who was the screenwriter for The Wrestler and Black Swan, is doing the screenplay for this.
And so you have no idea when the thing is going to go into production?
I don't. That's all I know, unfortunately.
Naveed Jamali has spent more than a decade in the technology management field. He joined the U.S. Navy as a reserve intelligence officer after his period as a double agent. You say you have no intention of going to Russia anytime soon.
Well, it would be a treat. It would be a very inexpensive trip, right? You don't have to pay the airfare there. Room and board is included, no airfare back.
His book, written with Ellis Hennigan, is How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. It's published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure.